Kristen?
So with I've been here a week, so I'm learning that the setup here is very dynamic. So those that haven't been here, please do chime in. Everything here is intended for questioning. So in the theme of the meeting with being the concept of resistance and evolution of resistance in cancer, I wanted to focus on a set of data that we have. Ultimately, will be the second half of the talk, and the first half of the talk will be some of the modeling, the mathematical modeling work we do to understand glioma growth and invasion, primary brain tumors known as particularly glioblastomas, the most aggressive of the gliomas. This is really work out of a wide diversity of folks in my group. The recurrent data that we're going to see at the end, in the sort of resistance context, is primarily run by a senior scientist in my group, Russ Rothney. So when a patient recurs after therapy, the real question that we're going to try and ask, but definitely not answer, is it still the same disease quantitatively, phenotypically, biologically? And if not, how should we treat it differently? Or how should we treat the primary disease differently so that the recurrence is somehow maintained in a longer stabilization perspective? So you'll see these two patients repeated over and over again during this presentation. These are two example patients that we do to sort of focus the concept on. You're a physician, you're sitting in something like a tumor board, and you're staring at images not unlike this. So weekly, patients at most institutions have some sort of weekly tumor board. On Wednesday, we'll in fact have some breast cancer specialists come in and do their tumor board, and they're gonna do like a mock tumor board. And they're going to discuss what the sort of decision-making is, and I'm going to try and give you a little context of what the decision-making is in the case of glioma, the primary brain tumor glioma, and particularly in these two cases right here, glioblastoma. So these are two patients on day zero. They're very similar. They're roughly 50 years old. One's male, one's female. This will be relevant to the next talk. They're both roughly left parietal lesions. They're kind of similar, right? I mean, from a global perspective, at least day 13 of this image and day zero of that patient is, you know, they're similar. So in each of these cases, I think I actually should really confirm this. Both of these patients showed up with a seizure, but that is at least the case in a vast majority of patients with glioma and glioblastoma in particular. And then in this case, they were seen in the community on these day zero time points. And then the day 19 or day 13 is the day of operation, so the day the surgeon went in to intervene in these cases. Because of the location of each of these tumors, the patients only ultimately received a biopsy. But other than that, from a surgical perspective, they received what we call standard care. So to make sure everybody's sort of on the same page on this topic, so glioblastoma, the most aggressive of the type of the primary brain tumors known as gliomas, the current treatments for GBM are based on basically statistical averages, ignoring individual behaviors. So upon clinical presentation, patient shows up with some of the images like I showed you on the previous slide, and there's some sort of surgical intervention. And that surgical intervention is intended to be, the goal is, a gross total resection, meaning remove what you see on the MRI. But that surgical intervention can be as minimal as literally a needle biopsy, and then the biopsy is used to assess what is the actual disease. From imaging, we have a good idea what the differential is, that is likely to be a glioblastoma, but you need the histological diagnosis under the microscope to confirm. And then, this surgical intervention again is used for diagnosis on the one hand, but also for cytoreduction, removal of significant number of tumor cells is the goal, if you can. And obviously that's strongly a function of where in the brain the tumor is, right? So you can't excise certain locations in the brain. Certain areas of the brain are more valuable per square millimeter, cubic millimeter than others. The standard of care now protocol following some sort of surgical intervention is what we call the Stupe protocol, named for the first author, Stupe, the reference of the paper, where there's a combination of conformal radiation therapy, which we'll talk a little bit about, which is basically taking the abnormality on MRI, expand out a little bit because we know these are diffusely invaded tumor cells in the brain, and I'll talk a lot more about that in a moment, and overlay a dose of roughly 60 gray over a six-week window, combined with a specific kind of chemotherapy known as temozolomide, which is an alkylating agent. And then they stay on the temozolomide, they cycle on the temozolomide until recurrence, okay, from an imaging perspective. So these are the comparisons, just to clarify what these curves are. unfortunately, the curves are somewhat similar at the very top part of this survival curve here. What's, I think, notable is that the tails are different. So it seems like there's a subpopulation of patients. The hypothesis behind this is that there's a subpopulation of patients that are driving sort of this big difference that you see. And so at recurrence, or progression, the word for recurrence, patients receive a variety of different things. It could be radiosurgery, could be anti-angiogenic therapies, could be a different kind of chemotherapy, could be something from the kitchen sink. And that's often the case where at the recurrent setting is often the case where new therapeutics are being introduced. So some new clinical trials are often structured to be at the recurrent setting because that's considered the least optimistic point for patients. So broadly speaking, a clinical challenge facing all of neuro-oncology is, can we quantify and predict the differential response to therapy, whether it's the Stupp protocol or some optimal therapy that you're choosing, for individual patients, so that we can tease out not just these curves of many hundreds of patients, but the individual dots, which are represented by each step on these curves. Now, if it hasn't become clear, this disease is in the brain, right? And so unlike, let's say, a leg sarcoma, where you could in theory imagine biopsying once a week or something like that, right? Our primary insight into the disease is through imaging. So this is an MRI scrolling from the bottom of the brain to the top of the brain of a glioblastoma. Red is the outline of the abnormality on imaging. We're going to scroll back down through the brain now. And so the point to this is that there's obviously exquisite detail to what the physicians have in their hands, right? What we understand behind this is, I think, the real challenge. So if you have an abnormality that you can reconstruct in this way, and these images are routine MRIs that every clinic has, the reconstruction is the only fancy bit here in the sense that you're sitting trying to show where this lesion is within the brain. But if you're the physician and the biologist interested in this disease, you know that if you were to zoom in onto a single voxel of tissue, you would see exactly this. So this, if you watch the loop here, I don't have the time meter on here, this is a 24-hour loop of a rat brain slice assay for a experimental rat model. But what's important here is that this migration rate that you observe in these individual cells is smack dab in the middle of the migration rate we observe in the human data. So this reflects what you would expect to see over a 24-hour window as you watch this loop. So the cells are migrating, proliferating, and potentially responding to the therapy that's being intervened. At least that's the sort of baseline concept. So although we've been talking about solid tumors over the last week, mostly, we've been talking about tumors as clusters of cells, right? There's a unique addition to the context for gliomas in the sense that these cells are individually migrating into normal brain, right? They're not tumor. It's tumor and gradient of cells as they intervene into, this is all normal tissue, right? This is all normal cells.
And what's the rough, what's the approximate of the spatial scale here?
This is calculating, each cell is about 10, 15, 20 microns. So I think it's kind of, I don't know here.
I'm sorry, how do you stain the tumor cells?
So this is an experiment. This is the only non-human data I'll show you. But it's the concept that your physician you're staring at, you know this is happening, but you just don't have a tool that shows you this dynamically. So this is these are DS red labeled cells within the context of a viral driven brain tumor model. So they basically inject a retrovirus into the brain that results in overexpression of PDGF. And that's basically, unfortunately, all it takes to create a glioblastoma. Scary. Lots of PDGF retrovirus with that. Don't get around that. But the point is that the dynamic rate of this is smack dab in the middle. What we've, using our human analysis of this human data, we know this is exactly relevant to the disease from a dynamic spatial perspective.
Just to point it for a moment, these are amazingly infiltrative and destructive in the brain, but the remarkable property about this, just to say it, is that they don't metastasize systemically, which is pretty remarkable.
Very good point, yes. Oops, what happened? That's an excellent point. I'm trying to get the movie to go start again. Okay, that's exactly an excellent point. So unlike some of the systemic cancers we talked about last week, the thing that's really profound is patients ultimately succumb to, let's say, breast cancer. It's not because their breast lesion gets too huge, right? It's because they have broad metastasis throughout the body. The exact mechanism of death is not completely well understood, but the thing is somewhat different in the context of brain is that it basically stays in the brain. or in the central nervous system, and only rarely metastasizes outside, like rarely, like 1% or less.
Yes. Are there circulating tumor cells?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's presumably the seed and soil issue. In other words, they could get somewhere, but they can't grow.
Well, and there are at least case reports of the concept of taking, let's say, patients with GBM. Hey, it doesn't metastasize, so let's do a liver transplant. Mm-hmm. They use the liver, and then they find the GBM in the liver to the recipient patient. So it exists. The cells are out there. They're just not necessarily seeding. There's many debates on that. Is it because they kill the patient, so the disease kills the patient so quickly? There's lots of other debates on that topic as well. So what I've been doing over the last many years has been building models that use routine information like this MRI data to get a dynamic understanding of the disease. But you have to have a small enough model, a simple enough model, that you could, in theory, parameterize that model using MRI data, okay? With this being the underlying concept, invasion being the number one rule. It's cancer, therefore it's proliferative. It's glioma, therefore it's invasive, right? And so you can write down very simple models, very simple reaction diffusion systems for describing tumor growth and invasion. So we have a proliferative curve term that without the treatment term, it's basically what's called Fisher's invasion, for everybody oriented here. The relevant things that I want to extract from this is that we have a migration rate, kind of a composite average for an individual patient, D, which varies in space within the brain. So if you're in white matter, the cells migrate much more quickly than they do in gray matter. Gray matter is where the neurons are. White matter is where the long axon fibers within the brain are that connect the various neurons together. So the migration rate is spatially differentiated, but I'm just going to refer to D as like the, it keeps on automating for it. The migration rate we're going to refer to a lot, D. So D, diffusion, dispersal, migration, any of those words are interchangeable. And net proliferation rate, rho. So it's a net measure of proliferative index, not just proliferation. It's proliferation minus death. So it's a net measure, and it's a very simple logistic growth term. And then presumably when we throw in treatment, something's happening. Let's hope. So the point is then you can go from something like this. So this is a three-dimensional view onto a segmented lesion, just like the red one I showed you before. So this is a tumor, abnormality on MRI. And you can use the model to go from, hey, this is the disease extent from an imaging perspective, and to this is the disease extent from a model prediction perspective, if you understand what the individual parameters are for each patient.
So there's some kind of critical density above which it can be detected in MRI.
That's the concept, yeah. There's much more complexity to it than that, but let's just go with that concept for the moment. And in fact, the terminology we use is that imaging reveals only the tip of the iceberg of the disease.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
I noticed that you hadn't related proliferation to migration, but most cells can't proliferate while they're migrating.
Not exactly at the same time, correct.
So is there a need, when thinking about time and growth, is there a need to think about highly proliferative tumors and the impact that has on migration, or highly migratory tumors and the impact that has on proliferation?
100% of times I give any talk related to anything to do with this work, I always get a related question, because temporally you can't have a cell that's both proliferating and migrating. However, if you watch those movies of that rat brain slice essay, you watch those cells, they're migrating like crazy, they're running, they're doing the gauntlet, and then pause for 2 seconds, proliferate, move on. So I think from a cell intrinsic perspective, you can get both phenotypes within the cell. Of course, they can't be running and splitting at the same time. Things tend to get a little chaotic when you do that. So from the perspective of temporal disassociation between proliferation and migration, yes. But from this measure, this is like a global measure of a population of cells. We're inferring an average D or phenotypic, overall D and overall row. And so you'll see that from the conglomerate, right? It completely ignores heterogeneity, which we totally acknowledge, but it's the limitations of the MRI. So yes. So imaging obviously is absolutely central to what we're doing in terms of understanding the disease, but imaging reveals only the tip of the iceberg. So again, reorienting yourself to that very first slide with those two patient examples, you have images like this on the top, and this is the actual clinical reality, and it's moving forward in time. How in the heck do you manage what you want to do clinically for a patient up here when this is the actual diffuse disease extent? So red is low cell density, white is health density on the bottom. So we use this iceberg analogy as a means of connecting MRI to a model. right? This is a extremely simplifying assumption. It has taken us very far in terms of how we can move these simplifying assumptions forward. And we have a lot of work in the lab that more directly connects what is the physics underlying the MRI versus the biology in the tumor and mapping those, but I'm not going to talk about those today. So for the sake of this argument, let's think of tumors like an iceberg and MRIs as detecting levels of the water, okay? So if you have two types of MRI that we sort of focus on are gadolinium-enhanced T1 weighted MRI, which is the green, and then a T2 weighted MRI, which is the pink. And those are the thresholds of detection or levels of the water. This gray thing is the iceberg or solution to the mathematical model. The slope and shape of this iceberg is going to be a function of how invasive the cells are, so it's going to pull the curve out, versus how proliferative they are, which will pull the curve up. So the ratio of those two tells you something about the steepness and the shape. But having a model that has both a proliferative capacity and an invasive capacity, very simple Fisher's equation like model, gives you a radial expansion of the tip of the iceberg that's consistent in time, and consistent in time at a rate related to the product of two squared of d rho. That's at least a good approximation. So you have a velocity of radial expansion that is related to how fast the cells are moving out versus how fast the cells are proliferating up. And then separately from that, the shape of the iceberg can be inferred from like the T1 GET and the T2 comparison. So very coarse assumptions, but it serves us well in taking routine pretreatment MRIs, because everybody gets these T1 GET and T2 MRIs. I mean, everybody does. Like, pick a spot in Timbuktu and you basically can get these images, right? It's just very, very base standard approach. So how can we take all comers in? We can get much more advanced in terms of how you think about this, looking at more advanced imaging, but let's just, for the sake of this argument, let's just focus on these very simple images. So you can take two pretreatment MRIs. We actually have a method that allows us to take one pretreatment MRI and estimate these individual parameters, but conceptually, we can get patient-specific net invasion and net proliferation rates from these MRIs. And then that allows you to think about something like this, where you've got an MRI that looks like this for this particular patient, and you can simulate on a segmentation of this patient's brain. You can segment the brain into gray and white matter and run a simulation with those rates of DNRO. Or you can do it on an anatomical atlas. This is an anatomical atlas, so the anatomy is slightly different, but similar. And you can get a predicted diffuse disease extent. And you can get the movie over time for any given patient. So going to your question, there's quite a lot of heterogeneity across this disease. So ignore the color scheme. It's actually colored for age of the patient, but it's not really relevant to this particular point. Is if you look at glioblastomas, there's like a diversity. This is 63 glioblastomas. So histologically, they're identical. The neuropathologist says they're the same. When you look under the microscope, they're considered in the same category. I use air quotes for the reason that we know biologically they're phenotypically quite different, but we don't have a means to infer that from just looking like under the microscope. So you can look at these 63 same patients, same disease, right? But it turns out there's quite wide phenotypic variability with some slight correlation between more proliferative being more invasive as opposed to anti-correlated, which is interesting, right? So to go to your comment. And to orient you to this space, right, you've got the top left corner are patients that are more proliferative, not very invasive, so their iceberg's gonna be very steep. Okay? Bottom right corner, the more you head down to this bottom right corner, you're not very proliferative, you're very invasive, so your iceberg's gonna be very shallow. So even if you had the same size of T1 GAD abnormality, your diffuse extent is quite different, okay? Similarly, bottom.
Kristen, can I?
Yeah.
So if you go sort of north of here, there's a number of research groups interested in the stiffness of some of the sort of mm-hmm. spatial mm-hmm. Heterogeneity in various physical properties. Is the edema, does the edema confer a stiffness or some change in the mechanical properties of either the brain or the tumor that is either a good thing or a bad thing? In the sense, is this niche engineering by the tumor that's creating an environment which is favorable to its own invasion, or does it represent a host response which is attempting to reduce the invasiveness? Or none of the above. I mean, just.
I think those are both great, great connections. I mean, right now we're like observing, inferring some, you know, metrics from overall MRI, but I think the biology underlying that is complex. So to read that out a little bit, if you look at the contrast enhancement here, right, on T1 GAD MRI, that's a result of an injection of a contrast agent, and that's leaking through the neovasculature. Because you notice not leaking here because the normal brain is protected by the blood-brain barrier. But in the tumor, certainly in the case of glioblastomas, there's a leakiness that's allowed. And that leakiness is just basically angiogenic vessels that are chaotic, that don't have very tight junctions, and so they're somewhat porous or weak. So with that concept, out leaks the contrast agent, which we can boldly see here, but also leaks with that, potentially, is water and other proteinaceous fluids from within the vasculature. So one thing that is related is the degree of contrast enhancement to this edema field, but it's not independent, because look, that one is contrast enhancing as well, and there's not a huge edema field, right? So what are the things between those that are making one be extensive and one not? And so one mechanism could be your sort of niche story about an inflammatory response, right? Could be just inflammation associated with, let's say, microglia or some other inflammatory component in the inflammatory response, where that's causing this additional layer of extra fluid that's being expanded brain. There's lots of different mechanisms of biology underlying it, but I think that's a really good point. Yeah.
And I think in addition, those properties, the leakiness of the blood-brain barrier, the amount of edema, also reflect functional interactions, mm-hmm. not just mechanical properties Agreed. Of tissue, but functional interactions between tumor cells and the endothelium and pericytes and microglia.
Yep.
And in fact, the proliferative rates and the migratory rates are not cell autonomous phenomena. They are stimulated by extrinsic factors.
Agreed.
And the endothelium is a primary source for many of those factors. So the ways that tumor cells modify endothelial cell properties influence their own proliferative rates and their own migratory rates
yep.
and their abilities to invade.
Exactly. So this is like a readout of what is that signal saying, or what is an inference of that signal, but biology underlying it is not what's modeled here. And I have a separate talk that would talk about looking at those mechanisms a bit more in detail, and how the tumor talks to its environment in various ways, and how the environment feeds back on that phenotypic behavior for the cells.
And do you have experimental systems where you manipulate any of that interaction in order to test these models for how predictive they are for proliferation and migration? So for instance, tumor cells will alter the endothelial cell expression of CXCL12, which regulates its directed migration and its proliferation. If you can disrupt that interaction, what happens in a model like this with a fluorescently labeled tumor cell?
So we have a path that I'm not talking about this week that goes in that direction with this. Basically, that's the dynamic video microscopy I showed you earlier. So there's a lab in Columbia, neuropathologist Peter Canal, who does all this experimental modeling that we do a lot of analysis on. So in fact, I could give a separate talk on looking at dynamic interactions between microglia in that rat brain slice assay sort of approach, microglia and tumor cells, and how those dynamics play out and speak to exactly the types of things that you're interested, that you're speaking to. So the focus on this has been, how do you take predictive modeling of images to predict other images or outcomes in the disease? So it's I've narrowed the scope for this particular presentation, but I appreciate and understand exactly what you're saying.
If you happen to give steroids and they're unusually effective and they reduce the edema, do you see a more rapid, do you change the behavior of the tumor?
Interesting. So there is a paper under review right now that is not from our group, but it has some of our data, not primarily from our group, that has some of our data that looks at introduction of steroids and synergism with radiation response. And basically what you find is that the steroids decreases the proliferative capacity of the cells, and that suppresses the radiation response because they're less proliferative than the radiation, and works really well on proliferating cells. So it's kind of the opposite almost of what you kind of at first gut want to say on the topic. If anything, it suggests that the suppression of that environment that you're talking about, that niche, selects for less proliferation, maybe. Maybe because there's less pressure. If you can imagine it being harder to get into this area, maybe, I don't know. Sure.
So apropos to your previous question, these brain tumors are rich in hyaluronan, mm-hmm. and CD44 expression is correlated with hyaluronan expression, and the rate of invasion and proliferation and so forth correlates directly with hyaluronan-rich influences the stiffness of the tumor.
Yeah, and that goes to the very cool magnetic resonance.
Yes, I mean, maybe the stiffness of the peritumoral normal tissue is the as important as a potential manipulate, you know, as a...
Well, and this gets into something...
Manipulate that as part of the...
It gets into something interesting about aged versus young brains, right? The very first signal in glioma in terms of outcomes is aged patients do more poorly, right? Do they, and what are the many mechanisms? And you can imagine, so there's a group, a colleague of mine, a neurosurgeon at...
The atrophy.
A colleague of mine at University of Washington has been taking the same sort of cell line, right, and putting it in aged versus young animals and finding that there's morphologically very different outcomes for the same exact cell line. So the milieu plays a role. And then aged, then repeating these in aged animals versus young animals, switching, it creates a very interesting dialogue. Okay.
Can I ask a much more low-level quantitative question? The points on the scatter plot somehow reflect the difference between two different MRI scans.
And then over time, yeah.
Oh, and there, okay, and there's a time component. Is there any way to get traction on error bars on these estimates?
Yeah, I didn't show them here. I'll show you some error bars on the later slides.
Okay.
Yep, yes.
I'm just trying to get a sense of where would that additional information come from.
So we have, one of my postdocs is an uncertainty quantification specialist, so she does. She adds all that beautiful landscaping to these pictures. Okay, so just to orient you, I guess bottom left is slow tumors, not very invasive, not very proliferative. Top right, fast, invasive and proliferative, so they're going really fast, right? So if you think of it from an iceberg-shaped perspective, lines of constant, you know, iceberg shape are like on the 45 and then on the negative 45 are lines of constant velocity. Does that make sense? Small to large? Okay. So let's revisit our two example patients, revisit some of the clinical challenges facing them. So I wanted to just remind you of those particular patients. They're both, again, similar. They both ultimately will receive only a biopsy followed by radiation therapy with a concurrent chemotherapy agent, different chemotherapy agents. And their the one relevant molecular marker they see is this IDH1 status. And for the record, both of them are IDH1 wild type. Although this guy, I think if you, in the presentations I've done related to using these patients, votes are often that this is an IDH1 mutant, but it is not. So with these patient individualized sort of net rates of invasion, net rates of proliferation, we can get a predictive model, at least at the MRI scale, right? Not thinking about these extra additional layers of complexity of the tumor dynamic, right? And so in this top tumor, it turns out this tumor is nodular, meaning steep gradient. Red is high cell density, blue is low cell density. You can easily see the red because there's not much blue in the way, whereas this patient in the bottom has a more diffuse tumor, and so red is high cell density, blue is low cell density, but the gradient is hard to see through, so you can't hardly see through the blue to get to the red. So what that really means is if you were to take a slice through these second MRIs, the second time point, so this is the pre-surgical MRI, you would imagine you could overlay a cell density gradient for each of these tumors in a single plane. Again, red high cell density, blue low cell density. And so now if you think about this, the standard of care, again, I said a target is resection, right? I don't think there's any neurosurgeon in the room, so no one will yell at me when I talk about gross total resection of this lesion, which you couldn't really functionally do. But given this sort of paradigm, what's interesting is you could do things like draw the region that you would have to remove in order to create a cytoreduction, a reduction of cells by 99%. So what margin would a surgeon have to attain to remove 99% of the tumor cells? That's what the green line is. And what's interesting is, although historically we treat resection as gross total resection is I got rid of the white abnormality, right? Success from a surgical perspective is the white abnormality gone? But as you know, the phenotypic differences across these tumors that we presented thus far is that tumors like this that are nodular, the tip of the iceberg reflects the majority of the tumor cells, the green contour is quite close to what would be considered a gross total resection. Whereas down here, it's quite different, right? And intellectually, this is known, but there's no quantitative way to order patients according to this so far. And there's been no signal that has been published at least. So what we did is we basically took, over the last 10 years, I built a database of about 1,400 patients where we have at least one type of time point of imaging. Probably a little over half of those patients have serial imaging over their entire lifespan, and we'll look at a lot of those details on in the patient data at the end on the recurrent setting. But we just basically looked at the database and we said, okay, we want a homogeneous group of patients that got a similar set of treatments, and we want to look at 250 of them, is what we found, and we'll pile them into three piles: nodular, moderate, and diffuse. Right, so nodular, steep iceberg; moderate, middle; diffuse, shallow iceberg. Okay, and then speak to the question of, did gross patients up here that received gross total resection do any different than patients that received gross total resection down here? And what you find is kind of exactly what you expect: that patients up at the top that received a gross total resection had an 8-month difference in outcomes. That's 75% increase in their outcome, whereas patients down here didn't have any significant measurable difference. Now, the backdrop here is, for the last, you know, we've been debating this, how much, just say in a sentence, how much do we rely on resection of an intrinsically diffuse disease, right? Just saying that sentence, you realize, wait, it doesn't necessarily translate that maybe approaching the disease surgically is the right thing to do. And so this has been a debate over many decades. And really about a decade ago was the first big paper, I think, that resoundingly showed a signal at about a 500 patient cohort where they could detect the difference between the curves consistently. It was like a defining study. And it was an amazing study because they resoundingly saw a difference between the curves to the tune of a couple, 3 or 4 months. What this suggests is that the signal driven by, observed in those sort of large scale patient studies, those 500 patient scale studies, are driven by a subpopulation of patients that are getting a huge benefit but drown out by patients that may not be getting that much benefit. And so if we can order this before treatment, then you have some, this is one practical way you can use these sort of models. Another way you can look at it is, I was mentioning this molecular marker IDH1. I'm trying to orient you to people who will talk about these various things in the next few days, so I wanted to make sure you could hit a few of the highlights. So IDH1 is a direct result of what we call the TCGA, Total Cancer Genome and Atlas. Where IDH1 was one of the big deliverables, right, of this large $100 million investment, which was basically looking at doing significant profiling on roughly 500 patients. I think the numbers are up now. And so one of the discoveries was that this particular mutation, and IDH1 is associated with malignant progression, meaning patients that go from low-grade glioma to high-grade glioma. This term for patients that have progressed from what are low, they didn't look as bad as they did under the microscope at first, but then some years later they look really bad, is this terminology of secondary glioblastoma. So 73% of secondary glioblastomas are IDH1 mutants, at least per this one example study. Whereas patients that, when they show up with a measurable disease and they go to the OR and their tissue is looked at and it's already glioblastoma, only 4% of what are called primary glioblastomas, meaning that they, again, they present with what are histological features of glioblastoma, are IDH1 mutants. So this IDH1 is an interesting marker.
Kristen, is the 73% after standard of care treatment?
No.
This is all just, I got a biopsy once, I didn't do anything about it.
Oh, so, okay, so then there's a diversity there. Yeah, so that's a really good question. No, that I'm interested in. 73% are secondary glioblastomas. Some patients, some institutions, the more social medicine institutions, socialized medicine countries, mm-hmm. tend to approach low-grade gliomas where they follow them serially. They may not intervene early. They may just do surgery. That's a possibility. But oftentimes, they kind of just follow them without any therapies other than maybe a resection. Mm-hmm. We have a kind of a smattering in the U.S. Where there's some people that believe in early surgical intervention, but maybe not following with radiation or chemotherapy mm-hmm. until a recurrent setting. So it's a little bit of a hodgepodge, but that would be really interesting to look at that data and find out what were they exposed to beforehand.
Yeah.
So the one element is IDH1 produces this novel acid, okay, that suggests some many things, right? Why does this mutation result in this novel production of this acid? So there's this whole theory, the pioneer of this concept in the audience, Bob Gatenby, on acid-mediated invasion. So thinking about this, we have a little evolutionary game theory model for looking at the role of IDH1 mutation, and we found the result of the model was that it would drive for invasion. And so we asked the question, does IDH1 mutation affect invasive phenotype of human gliomas? Are they related? And so we just basically looked shape of iceberg relative to mutation status, right? And so there's your shape of iceberg on the bottom, nodular on that end, diffuse on this end, and the IDH1 mutants were resoundingly more diffuse, and you could get a ROC curve of something with an area under the curve of like 0.92. So the point is that you can use this sort of formalism to say something about the macroscopic phenotype of the disease. But again, we're not speaking to the heterogeneity.
And what were you including as IDH1 wild type? These similarly low-grade gliomas that were wild type?
This particular study was all to contrast enhancing lesions.
So this is a big mixture then, because the IDH1 wild type tumors are going to be genetically quite distinct from the IDH1 mutant tumor.
Exactly. So the idea here was like, could you get an imaging signature that beforehand, before surgery, had a predictive capability of saying, yep, chances are you're going in for IDH1 mutant? Because there's a couple institutions in the US that have a belief that they want to go in if they're mutants, that there's a series of literature that says if they're IDH1 mutants, then that should portend for a better prognosis, therefore we should go in and do a larger surgical intervention.
But to compare primary high-grade glioma to primary low-grade glioma, which is presumably when the IDH1 mutant tumors presented and they got their MRIs, is to compare tumors that have been growing presumably for very different periods of time.
So the question here was, if you're a physician and you're going into the OR, how can we know from the MRI prior to treatment, newly diagnosed lesions, can we know prior to treatment whether we're likely looking at IDH1 mutant or not? That was what this question was answering. And what you found is that you could get an ROC curve of 0.92 to predict this is likely an IDH1 mutant, this one is not, from a contrast, so something that looked like it was a glioblastoma going in. They were contrast enhancing lesions from the start. So those are two examples of the patients that went in with a differential diagnosis with GBM. Could we predict which one of those was going to be an IDH1 mutant? That's the concept. So, and these were all newly diagnosed. So this is just at presentation, patients show up, we're going to go to the OR. None of these have been followed. None of them had low-grade progressing.
That's what's confusing, because the IDH1 mutants generally present as low-grade astrocytomas, not as glioblastomas.
Right, exactly.
So you wouldn't have thought that they were both glioblastomas going in.
But these didn't present. So this is his presentation MRI. This is the presentation MRI from this patient.
Was a glioblastoma at diagnosis, or was a low-grade astrocytoma?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
So that's the problem. This is prior to diagnosis. You're the surgeon, and you don't have a diagnosis yet. All you have is an image. So can you know prior to the surgery what's going to play out? Because what we're finding is, like, the group at MD Anderson and Emma at MGH, they would take a patient like this, and they would go in and do a relatively small resection on this. And let's say they did just the T1 GAD abnormality. Once they found it as an IDH1 mutant, their philosophy is that you should go in and do an even bigger resection if you can. If they had a predictive signature prior to treatment, to know that ahead of time, that was what this message is sent out.
But those imaging features are those high-grade gliomas, so those are GBM. They just may not have had an antecedent history of low-grade tumor.
Exactly.
But it's a high-grade tumor, it's a GBM that just happens to be...
From an imaging perspective, it's a GBM.
They may have had a previous history of low-grade,
right.
We don't know.
Yeah, these were newly show up, they show up with this image, go. It's not like they were followed. There was not a subset of these patients that were followed with some non-contrast enhancing, and then it turned contrast enhancing.
Is every cell an IDH1 mutant?
I don't know. I don't know. In one of the talks we had recently, I'll show you this example where somebody else probably worked. So you can use this to do a couple other things, right? So you can generate these pretreatment images. We're going to go back to that patient example. You can generate your virtual control. In this case, simulated as a straight line of that actual simulation evolving over time. And then you can start thinking about what does that mean for response to therapy. So currently, when you look at a clinical trial, when you look at standard of care, when you look at the assessment of response to therapy, there's a couple different criteria. There's McDonald, RECIST, RANO. RANO is response assessment in neuro-oncology, is the primary tool that's used in neuro-oncology. And basically what it says is, if you've got a pre-treatment image, post-treatment image, did the tumor get smaller? If the tumor got smaller, then that's a response, and it's measurable difference, right? So it's like 25%, 30%, sort of smaller, measured by various ways. Could be multiple orthogonal axes. In this case, this is actual three-dimensional segmentation of the volume. So from this perspective, the tumor smaller, you can differentiate out patients that are responders versus non-responders. But what you see just by the way of drawing this picture, right, response may be different if you've got a curve that's the tumor would have been this size without treatment versus this size without treatment, right? So the growth curve that they live on, the distance down, is at least intuitively some measure of response. So you could think of this as like a radial treatment response. You could think of this axis as a temporal treatment response, a temporal delay. So how long did we delay growth by the therapy that's intervened here? So we've generated a couple metrics, like this one is what we termed days gained.
Kristen?
Yes.
In the MRIs, is the upper right, is that the end result of, was there ever a complete response?
Nope.
And then this recurred, or is this?
Standard first post-op, so patients go in, they have these images right here, they get surgery, then they get radiation therapy concurrent to mesothelioma chemotherapy, and then a month later they get an image. This is the standard follow-up time point for those images. There's occasionally patients, different folks are interested in getting a mid radiation image, but it's not very common. So in this case, you could measure this out, and it turns out we looked at, in this case, a pile of 63 newly diagnosed GBMs. Ask the question, does the temporal delay that you introduce in this disease portend for outcome? And it does. So the more you've temporally delayed the growth as a result of the therapy, in this case standard of care, you could differentiate responders versus non-responders such that you could dichotomize the curves in terms of like an 8-month difference in the curves. So, and this is time of progression, how long does it take until the image gets worse? And that's going to be relevant to the next couple slides, the next several slides, and then this is survival.
Would you label them as non-responder based on the criteria?
Small days gained, right? Yeah. I don't think we gained much traction with this therapy. Yeah. I mean, we deflected off that much growth, right? So it just came out as a dichotomy for this. It was actually a really robust valley. You could have chosen many different cutoffs. There was like a large, you know, valley.
Yeah.
So the point is like having some kinetic insight into the disease gave some insight into response. Unfortunately, I took this slide out, but if you did exactly the same thing and just cohorted responders and non-responders, these same 63 patients according to the Randall criteria, the curves overlie. So there's no statistical difference in the, did it get smaller, the disease get smaller with treatment. It's the degree to which you deflected the tumor off. Its growth curve seems to portend for a better predictor of whether the patient actually did well. So you can imagine how challenging that is if we had, for our existing response criteria, things like RANO, in this case of 63 patients, for instance, didn't tell you, hey, we had a response, therefore that patient did well. Imagine now if you're thinking about a new therapy. You've got some clinical trial, some new drug, and you're trying to figure out, have we made an impact on this disease? And there's lots of fancy imaging techniques that people can use to look at different measures of, did we affect proliferation? Did we affect any of this? We've been looking at this in a variety of ways, and this is a paper we just published in looking at a very early stage gene therapy in phase one study of in glioblastoma. So these are newly diagnosed glioblastoma patients that are ultimately gonna receive a bone marrow transplant that's going to protect their bone marrow so you can allow dose escalation of temozolomide. So you can give the patients a lot more temozolomide because we're going to protect the bone marrow from the temozolomide. That's the short version of the story. We can talk about that in great detail, but it's not the big picture here. So what we did is we generated these patient individualized simulations approximated here by this straight black line, and it's basically those images up there for each of the tumors, and then we assessed at the post-treatment time points what was their degree of deflection for each of these tumors. And even there was only 4 patients in the study when we became involved, and we could detect early on, you have these decisions in these early phase trials. Should we pursue this? Is this, do we have traction? When do we have traction, right? And if all the patients live 5 years, then right, that's great. But unfortunately, we haven't had that case, certainly not in recent history in this disease.
So, sorry, but the crosses are the data.
Correct.
Okay.
So what we found is that even just using 4 patients worth of data, you could detect the days gained per milligram of temozolomide or the days gained alone. Obviously the patients on the protocol are receiving large doses of temozolomide, whereas the patients on the like control patients that are matched for the same growth curve and the same age and the same clinical features had lower doses of temozolomide because they were receiving standard doses of temozolomide. So the idea was to measure the degree of benefit of adding all that extra temozolomide to the patient. And so we just measured that, and even with four patients, you could detect a very strong signal early on that there was a bigger response in the patients in terms of deflection of the growth curve in the patients that were on the protocol. And this was only with four patients. So this is, it's just an early way of thinking about how you can provide insight using sort of models like this. Okay, so now we're going to talk about kind of really segue to this whole recurrent setting. I'll give you the last example, which is, I've walked you through, like, prior to diagnosis, how do we get an IDH1 mutant, which is the only, you know, one of the only relevant molecular features that people are using, you know, clinically. How do we respond, how do tumors respond to standard of care, resection, talked about that. Now we're going to, and how do you look at an early phase study of newly diagnosed tumors. Now we're going to talk about radiation therapy, which is what comes next, okay, in the standard of care. So there's basically a simple model that we can write down, which basically is the same exact model before, except where we've written out what the radiation model is. And the radiation model is using a simple linear quadratic term that relates dose to surviving fraction. It's a very simple radiobiological model that has been in use for many eons. So the nonlinear form of this set of equations here has several assumptions underneath it. We have an increased interstitial pressure slash hypoxia that modulates the radiation dose response, because it's not just surviving fraction, but there's some modulation by carrying, like, local cell density. There's decreased necrotic cell clearance because of also this term is only relevant when there's a lot of cells around and therefore potentially necrosis. And there's sort of the lowering dose per cell. So this, I'll try and breeze right past this, but I wanted you to understand that in intrinsic in our model where you add radiation, you can go to the treatment planning system and extract out the dose plan. Okay, so this is the radiation dose that's applied to this patient. Red is high dose, not cell density, and blue is low dose. You overlay it on the map of disease. So you've got a model of disease of the iceberg evolving over time, and then you have a map of dose that's being applied to that disease. And you just put those two together, and you can say, look, if I overlay that dose onto the model, you would have a model curve that this is, if the patient was low radiosensitivity, they would have deflected a little. If they were high radiosensitivity, they would have deflected a lot. And since you have the two pre-treatment time points and you have the one post-treatment time point, you can infer what the radiosensitivity had to be, because each of these curves is a different radiosensitivity, which we call alpha. Okay. So what we found is that when you apply this to patients, in this case it's 24 patients that had similar approaches, you could correlate the radiosensitivity to the net proliferation rate and find faster proliferating tumors are more radiosensitive. It's kind of a duh. However, you can also use this black line as a good predictor of the radiosensitivity in an individual patient. And even with the diversity we see here, that means that from a pretreatment perspective, you could predict the radiosensitivity in an individual patient to the tune of a couple millimeters accuracy in predicting what the post-treatment MRI is going to look like. So again, giving you some insights into not only the standard of care, but also how you could use, and there's some error bars for you, and how you can use some of these model approaches to, again, go from MRI, same disease, they're both glioblastoma, both the same patient, similar age, they're similar, all these other things, to, hey, this patient on the top is turns out to be very radiosensitive, this patient on the bottom turns out to be very radioinsensitive, having a very low deflection of the tumor off of its growth curve. So the patients this patient that was treated had a very small deflection of its growth curve as a result of radiation versus this patient. Large.
Can I just understand the treatments here? In the first part of your talk, the deflections were the consequence of surgery, right?
In the first part of my talk, that was actually with radiation.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
So the very first slide with the green, that was just talking about surgery, differentiating surgery and kind of ignoring that they, whatever they had else response-wise, but there's another confounder is that they had other things, right?
Right.
And so the classic thing is, like, a patient's going to receive, it's only going to get worse from here. They're just going to receive all these treatments, and how do you say, how did I benefit this thing versus that thing, or versus all those things added together? And how did they fight against each other? It's a very challenging problem, right?
Yeah. But your days gained assays or examples, for example, were a consequence of radiation.
Yes, and that previous picture was with radiation. It was exactly this time, this 1 month post the end of radiation therapy.
Okay,
so what I dream about is things like this, where you take some surgical plan, you can take some radiation plan, and when we want to apply them, have some pretreatment image, have a pretreatment understanding of what the untreated growth curve is going to be for this particular tumor, and then play it out, and then have an expectation with, of course, uncertainty bars around this. So imagine a hurricane plot, you know, when they have a projected map, is it going to hit New Orleans or not? It's like that sort of concept of uncertainty. And be able to have these patient individualized suite of simulations of what's going to happen if we just use standard of care. So the crazy thing is, and the cool thing is that like radiation therapy, we have a lot of flexibility in actually how that's applied. There's actually some diversity across clinics. Resection also, there is some diversity across different approaches, this whole IDH1 story, right? So some patients do approach IDH1 mutants where they want to go and give a bigger resection. But not everybody's doing that, right? So there is some diversity in these hands, and so you can imagine being able to play these stories out using predictive models. Yes.
This is very quickly. How much difference does it make in kind of the first study that we in the operation?
So the question is, would it matter if I did a resection here versus here?
Well,
versus
in
here.
Your two slides are 0 to 19 days.
Yep.
You can visually see the brain block, and if you resect it in 3 days, and not 19.
Yep. So people have looked at that. We've been trying to look at that as well. I don't think it's a resounding signal of what it is, because I think the answer is really driven by the residual, right? And not all patients can get a gross sort of resection. So I think it's a very confounding problem. We actually haven't played it out, though, in terms of with like a large set of patient data play out, hey, did it matter if we did a resection later? Because I think clinically it's expected, and although in low-grade gliomas, it's unknown whether you should resect early versus late. Not necessarily unknown, but there's diversity in clinical choices. In GBM, it's really get it now. That's the philosophy. And I think you would be butting your head against that philosophy pretty resoundingly, and that might be painful for one's forehead. Yes.
What happens to this? So you had surgery and there's that gray space.
Yep.
What is really happening in there when you go and you take a tumor out? Is it open space in your brain at the end
yep.
of the day?
Yep.
That
it's
fills up with
spinal fluid.
Yep.
Spinal fluid.
No,
and the brain can also, it's like jello, so it kind of...
It'll fill in a little bit.
The surgeon puts a gel in to fill out that space, and sometimes...
No, they actually don't fill it up. They'll actually put the gel in the
face. Around the edge.
Bleeding,
yeah,
but
exactly.
It passively fills up the fluid.
Yep.
And what is the gel?
Different? For different?
Depending what
yeah,
surgery...
Surge cell is the main one.
Okay, thank you.
I love how the slides move forward on all by themselves. That's great.
The predicted slope curve is always linear. Do you think that's what it is?
In this picture, I have shown you that. In low-grade gliomas, where we followed them serially for 15 years, so imagine they're doing the same things, they're just doing them slower, right? So it's the same, similar disease quantitatively.
Yeah.
Straight line. Works out.
So, well, that's low-grade. I'm not sure if they're the same things, they're just going slower.
We have data coming out of the group right now that's now looking at this many hundreds of patients that we have, and we're seeing a very good signal for linearity. But it's not.
But have two time points in it, isn't it?
Oh no! We have more in our database, right? In the subset of patients for which we have more data points, can we predict the third point? And that's one of the things that we've got. So I have a series of autopsy patients that were serially followed without intervening treatment, and it's smack dab on the line. I didn't bring the slide, but I always show that slide for exactly this question. I think the linearity, so mathematically, let's speak about it mathematically. From a mathematical perspective, if you play out a reaction diffusion system like this, Fisher equation, in the complexity of the brain, or outside of the complexity of the brain, spherical caps, right, spherical brains, then you basically get a traveling wave solution, which is linear in time. In the brain, in the complexity of the brain, now you're adding in boundaries of the brain and gray-white heterogeneity, right? So homogenization theory gets you from gray-white heterogeneity to some reasonable reflection of an effective diffusion coefficient that's going to give you basically linearity if you had a spherical brain sort of idea. If you then add the conformity of the brain, not all our although I showed you very simple simulations that were showing that just happened to work out, there was nice linearity, not all the simulations show that. I was just showing that those as these examples because it gets really distracting when people start seeing the curves going random directions. What we found is that when there's significant boundary effects, meaning the tumor is really diffused and the boundaries are nearby, then you get more of a deflection and you get more of a complexity of the growth curve. But mathematically, again, assuming the tumor wasn't in the brain, a model like that where you have a diffusion process and a logistic proliferative process is going to give you basically linearity.
Yeah.
not perfectly that, but asymptotically it would be. So it's an interesting question. And even with the complexity of the gray and white, you play out these simulations, we've got millions of these simulations across whatever, and you get a lot of consistency to that pattern.
I have basically the same question as Marco, but I was wondering if you have animal models different, and how well you predict things if you don't give any intervention.
So in the animal model context, there's several worries on that front. One is, I think I used to say until about 5 years ago, I didn't believe any of the animal models at all, because they all were they grew like little balls, and you could, you know, the joke was that you could pop them out and pop them right out of the brain. They didn't have the invasion, which is the whole, what I think is like defining of this disease. And I think philosophically it's defining of this disease. Second, the experimental models, the one experimental model that I do work with is that PDGF driven model, because it has that beautiful invasive pattern, and at least that's consistent with, miraculously, that conversation began as a result of, hey, I'm getting complaints about my model being too invasive, basically, and they're going too fast, and then you go, oh, well, let's just measure it. So you do some self-tracking, and then do like wind rose plots, quantify the diffusion coefficient of those cells, and it would just happen to be smack dab in the middle of what we were observing in the patient. The problem is it was killing the animals so quickly, they were like, oh, this can't be physiologic, except for the fact the brain of the rat is this big, that big, right? And the brain of the human is presumably bigger than that, right? So those things, just the geometry of the situation dominates at a signal like that. So I get really concerned when we want to go back to the animal to validate. I'm more thinking about forward looking, how do you generate predictive tools? I think you can use the animal model to inform some like limitation of some of the biology that might be playing out, or some ideas of like what could limit the, what biology I can dream up in my head. But I don't know that I could validate back. I think I could validate forward in patients in various ways, but I think I get really confused when I think about head back, because I keep on thinking of his back. And so that's giving you my complete bias very early on in this conversation.
Have you ever considered using your patient specimens to generate phenotype?
Yeah. So that I think is a very interesting protocol, is at least to look at patient-derived cell lines, and then of course immediately I say something like that to Bob, and Bob goes, well, what about the context? And I agree, and so then we get into this little circle of how much can you do. And so I actually find a very interesting project would be to take these PDX lines that are thrown in these animals, and all sorts of cool things are done with them, and find the degree of similarity between what I predict from the clinical imaging perspective into those animals where you just constrain the domain, right? How much of it is domain? How much of it is then separate biological processes?
Absolutely.
I think there's a really cool project there, and I actually got some traction on doing that project this summer. So, because I think, you know, there's a lot of open questions. Okay, so I that was a really long segue into really what I wanted to get to, the meat of the data.
I'm sorry, but one more question, if you don't mind, on the iPad app. It looks like the linearity looks like the slope goes up after radiation. Is that just a cartoon, or is that stereotypical?
That was actually not a cartoon in that particular case, but I'll show you here.
Okay.
That's exactly what I wanted to get to. So I sorry for that long introduction. Really isn't about resistance. That long introduction was to orient you to GBM, and what are the questions that are faced in this disease, and to orient you to some of the modeling tools that we've used. And now with that construct build, let's talk about resistance and recurrence. This is a rendering of one of our patients in our database that received standard of care. So patients, there's the pretreatment MRI, there's the surgery, they had a, going to your question, temporal lobectomy, so hopefully it gave you a hole here, and then received temozolomide concurrent with conformal radiation therapy, just like in that 3D spinning movie, and then metronomic temozolomide. 5 days on, 23 days off. It's a slightly different schedule during radiation therapy. So generally lower dose and tighter together, but there you go, that's the visual concept. And so for any given patient, routinely if you're following those patients, this is the type of serial imaging that you're looking at. You're looking at the wound that is the surgical bed somehow filling in various ways. It could be the tissue actually expanding into the area, could be different blood products or post-operative changes, as they say, also in air quotes. I'm using air quotes too much today, apologies. And then you ultimately get something like this, some sort of little bright spot that's concerning.
Can I?
Yes, sir.
So in these intermediate periods, now you've taken out the primary, the infiltrating tumor, the cells that are presumably are off sort of guerrilla warfare in the retinal brain. are they continuing to move forward? Does anybody know what happens to them during, as their primaries are accepted?
So glad you asked that question, Bob.
Okay.
I'd like to answer that. I'd love to find the answer to the question. I'll show you some data that talks to, speaks to that.
Is that tumor that's, let's presume that's a recurrent tumor. Yeah. Is that, was that tumor left behind?
Nope.
Presumably?
Well, presumably, yes, from a, like a diffuse invasive perspective. So if you think of the iceberg and resected and you've got something sub-threshold, some
so somewhere in there was a nodular tumor that's now progressed, as opposed to it being repopulated by tumor outside of the surgical and radiation, or, you know, radiation treatment area, it simply moved back. You know, as you've got this reservoir of
I think it's the reservoir.
What do you think? Tumor cells have moved back.
I think they were there, and it was a gradient like this that was right. Sub-threshold. You cut off this top, right?
Okay.
You put a hole in it, right?
Okay.
So and then they grew up, and then now they're above the threshold.
So you think this is at the edge of the tumor, of the resection? And,
yeah, like, I don't know, 90% of the time it's like recurs at the edge.
There's certain residual tumor cells that may not be cycling within the, even within the radiation field. We know that there are a lot of infield failures despite even very, very high dose radiation.
Exactly.
So these are presumably residual cells that have survived.
So they're just tough.
Yeah.
And they're not cycling. They weren't high in distance.
Correct.
Coming back.
Yeah, correct.
So one of the things that we do is actually look at that, the radiation field dose, right? Is like, can we optimize, given some understanding of the shape of the iceberg and how fast the iceberg is evolving, what the optimal radiation dose and structure should be? But that's, again, a different topic.
Models out there, I mean, there are presumably cells at quite a wide distance from the resection cavity, but virtually all recurrences happen in the resection cavity.
Right, which
so
is,
Eric Holland in particular has been working on how inflammatory mediators generated in the inflammatory, in the resection cavity, both by surgery and then by radiation to that rim, are increasing the likelihood that it's the cells that reside within the resection rim that have the highest likelihood of.
Are we stimulating them from like a wound healing perspective?
It's just sort of interesting.
Because there's a button on PDGF, I'm going to presume that just is right there. And I just proved earlier that you just add PDGF to a rat brain and you get GBM. So
these cells that are radiating presumably don't sort of coalesce and pop up a tumor at some distant site.
The thing from a perspective of a tumor, it's just not a tumor. It's just a gradient of cells that like the local observation of this contrast enhancement is a function of there's enough of them around that they've stimulated the local environment to need angiogenesis, and then they have angiogenesis, and then those angiogenic vessels are leaky, and therefore the contrast agent shows up. It's that problem of confounding tip of the iceberg phenomena. How do you separate
it's
that
something
out?
Something at that local adaptive landscape
I think it's very true, and I think 90% of surgeons that I've, you know, sat in tumor board or grand rounds of equivalent with have always said, well, you know, it depends on how much I've, you know, called them back by my resection, by intervening in the first place, right? I think there's a really big wound healing or, you know, tapping into the native, systems, right?
So the concept of calling back is kind of interesting. Is that oral tradition or is that really true?
Yes. Yes. Nobody knows. So that was one of the first things we did was very early on. I would take these simulations, and the surgeon I was working with in Seattle was Dan Silbergeld. He was very interested in invasion, and so weekly he would say at tumor board, oh well, you know, it depends on how much I wounded the brain, and therefore it's calling them back. He would use those terms, and I always found that strange. But the point was is that you could explain the observation of behavior without that additional wounding. You could explain the tip of the iceberg popping back up where it pops back up, without that wounding. I think the wounding or whatever you want to call it, the homing, whatever the heck you want to call it, the additional milieu only adds synergy, energy to that possibility.
And the highest density of cells that are left behind are on the
right there. Yeah, where are they going to go?
So, even before you invoke magic.
Right, so you don't need magic to get the answer. And that was exactly what I showed. It was like a series of papers that was like, you don't need the additional magic, and there's no magic in it. It's a real thing, the wound handling process, but you don't need additional to get there. Mm-hmm. And therefore, is the primary signal just simply that that's where the tip of the gradient of cells that you just can't see is.
Though the pattern of recurrence changes, for instance, with Avastin therapy. So you no longer see the dominant local recurrence when you treat with Avastin.
Yeah. Partially because what you're doing with Avastin is making the imaging do something completely funky, and then you've got this popping out.
Except that, you know, with experience, I think radiologists and everybody else have become familiar enough with the way that Avastin changes imaging to still use imaging. And you end up with distant metastases with Avastin therapy, which you don't end up in the absence.
Yep. And there's the whole literature for everybody that, with Avastin therapy, there's this whole literature that basically pro-invasion, you know, anti-angiogenics are basically pro-invasive. And so cells are even more invasive than they would be before. Part of that is that you suppress the imaging signal, though, right? So if you put an anti-angiogenic in this disease, which I'll show you in a few minutes, this contrast enhancement can essentially eliminate in like 24 hours. Depending on the anti-angiogenic, it just goes poof, gone. And so your image gets better. Now you've closed up those leaky vessels and the edema pattern will shrink because there's less leakage of extra stuff into the space, right? So that there's a confounding aspect to your observing with imaging patients that have received anti-angiogenic, because you're suppressing the signal that we've spent 50 years trying to prime, to detect, right?
In fairness, there are other ways of imaging, right? You don't have to.
Oh, no, of course. Of course.
You can image recurrent tumors in the absence of gadolinium enhancement.
Sure. Okay. We can debate that all day.
not in Merrimack Valley Community Hospital.
Yeah. That's right, exactly right. I think no different than the tip of the iceberg. Like you resect out the center, right? And the gradient is like, you know, this is the best chance that you're going to grow up, right? And then that's going to be where you're going to show up. The recurrent disease is going to show up. I think a significant component, not all, a significant component of the disease recurrence patterns you see with post anti-angiogenics is the fact that you suppressed your imaging signal so much, then all this growth has happened, and then when it shows back up and it's like resisted over, you know, become resistant, if we call it that, to the anti-angiogenics, it's just going to pop back up and it's going to be hugely dispersed. So I think there's a big component of the signal that is that. The degree to which that's the primary component of the signal is not known yet. But it's something we're actually interested in and we're doing, but not in this talk.
The peritumoral stiffness may, I
like where you're going with that.
In other words, if the anti-angiogenics get rid of the edema, perhaps that is a dispersal element and
right.
One that allows greater coalition in your body. I think it's just interesting to me. I never thought of it until
your
images that we do have a mechanical component to this that might be interesting.
So is there a compartment that's very diffuse and you end up detecting recurrence? A discrete recurrence at the tumor margin, but there's a pre-existing diffuse compartment that's
exactly
impossible to detect.
That's like exactly the point.
Kennedy, he had no
right.
discernible mets.
Right.
He just died because he had billions of cells infiltrated.
We know there's a non-zero chance that there's a cell here, right? Okay, at least one. Let's just go with that. Right. So we know that, and so if you suppress your ability to detect that, and then when it breaks out of its ability to be suppressed, right, then if it shows up over here, it looks really confounding. It's like, oh my God, this is a really disseminated disease. And it may be that there's an additional biological mechanism that is pushing towards dissemination, because if you're not allowing local angiogenesis, then you're suppressing the ability of that cell to continue to proliferate. That cell can't proliferate because it can't get angiogenic response to provide nutrients to it. Then it's going to go, well, screw this, I'm leaving, I'm going over here. And so that additional mechanism of migration is very simple, right, that you could have that. I just don't know the quantitative difference between how much of it is we make this images so much prettier and how much of it is this additional biological pushing towards an invasive phenotype. So I think that's a really great open question that is, I mean, it's something we're actually really working on. Again, that's like a fourth talk that I can tell you about. Okay, so standard of care. So what you see here is a feature of something, temozolomide's everywhere, right? Okay, until recurrence, and then a decision is made. And that decision can involve these anti-angiogenics. So to get to the resistance idea, there's this recent paper that just came out that was looking at recurrent disease. So temozolomide treated prior to recurrence, look at this disease, versus these patients over here, where you have different grades of the patients, and then you're looking at basically the number of somatic mutations that are shared between the initial and the recurrence, so that is this color. They're private to the initial tumor versus private to the recurrence. So this paper speaks to this whole question of does temozolomide do something extra bad, right, by inducing some sort of diversification from a molecular perspective. Okay, so there's lots of open questions of what does this continual force of chemotherapy mean? And so there's, I encourage you to look closely at this paper, but I want to move past this. So we went back to our database and we asked the question of, we wanted to look at how different basically is the recurrent disease from a quantitative perspective, a kinetic perspective from the primary. And so lots of different criteria. We basically limited things in a lot of different ways. We basically wanted Stupp protocol, nothing else, diversity. We didn't want to add, we were trying to avoid confounders of various points, but so that's the summary here. It's kind of great detail you don't really need. What we defined recurrence was very detailed, basically when were we officially on an upslope where you could detect a significant positive change in terms of growth of the curve. And I'm going to ignore all these words because all it is visual. So here's an example of a patient in our database. So I mentioned we have this database, like 1,400 patients. This is what a patient in the database looks like. So this is a PHP front end to a MySQL back end from a technical perspective. And behind each of these dots is a three-dimensional segmentation of an MRI. Okay. On this axis is tumor radius measured as segmented volume, tumor volume. Do basically the cube root of that and get a mean radius. Annotated across the bottom are these treatments. So on the leftmost, you see a subtotal resection followed by temozolomide concurrent with radiation therapy, followed by cyclamide, temozolomide, followed by another resection and with dexamethasone, which is a steroid, followed by continued dexamethasone, a couple of chemotherapy agents, some carboplatin, and a four-drug program. So this is an older patient from time in Seattle. And so these are the kind of growth curves that you observe. Purple is flare and T2, they're very similar. One suppresses the central CSF, one doesn't. So flare suppresses the CSF, so it's a little bit easier to say abnormality associated with tumor versus not. But you can see that they're very closely correlated because they should be. Then red curve is the T1 GAD, so gadolinium enhanced T1 weighted MRI. And the green curve is the blood product or other products that would explain the T1 GAD signal, right? So after surgery or even in the context of a stroke, you have blood product on imaging that is naturally contrast enhancing, okay? Not naturally enhances, it's naturally bright on T1 gadolinium enhanced T1 weighted MRI. And so you've got to differentiate out the signal of what we are associating with tip of the iceberg signal of like presumably cells versus there's just blood there, something associated with surgery. So in this case, this was a large subtotal resection at this time point. So the T1 GAD was here. There's a big, still big signal of T1 GAD abnormality, gadolinium enhanced T1 weighted MRI. But the vast majority of it is attributed to post-surgical blood product and the like. So this difference between these two curves is basically imaging disease, okay? From gadolinium enhanced. Is that clear? So I'll show you some images. That's the prior to treatment image for this patient. And this is one of these. This is in the recurrent window down here.
And so that red spike is what prompted the surgery, the second surgery.
Yep, exactly. This is the clinical progression. Let's do something. So we used these curves to look at the steepness of those curves and our D row story in these two different contexts. So here's another example. This is prior to treatment. Temporal going to receive a big temporal lobectomy, as you would predict. And there is a small nodule recurrence right there. And then here's another one. So less than a surgical case in this case. Okay, oops, pressing too many buttons. All right, so you can see that there's quite a diversity across the patients, but the whole point was we were trying to identify growth kinetic at recurrent in the recurrent setting, right? And use those associated images to assess this D row story. And this is what we found. And so y-axis is recurrence, x-axis is a diagnosis, happy uncertainty bars are there. Proliferation rate, so net proliferation rate, net invasion rate, net invasion profile, so D over row, net invasion rate and velocity. And generally speaking, we see the proliferation rate goes down at recurrence. The net proliferation rate goes. The velocity goes down, interestingly enough. There are a few rare beasts that go up, right? So to your question, and then the invasion rate could go either way, and the invasion profile could kind of go either way. That's at least the signal we observed. Plotting this out in this way in terms of D rho, you see gray diamonds are the diagnostic pretreatment, and then in the recurrence setting, they're black. And so you can just see sort of a shift this general direction. So so again, reminding you of what these corners of this atlas mean.
Can we please go back to
sure.
the first patient graph you showed? I'm sorry.
The first patient?
Yeah, the first patient. Yeah, this guy.
Yep. Right
there. Yeah. So clearly, at what is it, about 450 days or so, the tumor suddenly seemed to get a little bit past that. Yeah, right there. It suddenly took off.
Yep.
Is that an imaging artifact of how they sliced that tumor with the MRI? Is that really, I mean, like, how much of that do you see in imaging from?
So one thing I would make note of here is using the green curve.
Yeah.
Okay, so a lot of the T1-GAB signal is attributed to by basically 100% attributed to by the T1 signal. So that's the natural enhancement, right? So the blood. Well, let's just call it blood for the sake of this argument. So there was no so the real signal you're looking for is the distance between these two. Now imagine you're sitting there. I'm gonna draw a curve with some chalk. In your cells, migrating, proliferating, you have something like that. And there's your threshold of detection, right? Mm-hmm. So if you look at the radius versus time of this thing as it keeps growing, it's going to pop over the thing and just keep growing, right? That's growth in time. What you find is that it's silent, 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 absolutely nothing to, woo, goes like that. That's what the curve actually looks like. So there's an initial transient that's very steep, very fast. And then this is the 2 squared d rho slope over here. So this initial transient could be what you're seeing. That's the way I would explain that initial curve of it being fast compared to, let's say, what's going on up here. But it could be something interesting. I don't know.
Is it faster?
That's why we're asking.
Is it faster in more nodular tumors?
Don't know. Here, well, I'll show you. There.
Oh, okay.
So this is the tantalizing early data of figuring out does nodular mean you're going to go.
Do you think MR spectroscopy might be useful to help dissect what's happening?
So I think there's many confounding things here, right? One is after treatment, the brain is, different. So the MRI is presumably measuring some slightly different signal. The vessels are sclerotic, for instance. So from a biological mechanism, if you believe the MRI to be exactly what we think it is, which is something like a tip of the iceberg, which it's not, okay? There's a whole bunch of biology there. You could just even think about, okay, well, the vessels are more sclerotic, so maybe they're not delivering as well, and therefore it's easier to become hypoxic, and then you're pushing biologically one direction. From an imaging perspective, maybe that means they're leakier, and so you always get more T2 signal because maybe they're just not as good because they've been radiated. There's so many different ways that we can explain this. This is actually why we only just now have been really looking really closely at this recurrent setting, because I think there's so many confounders. But I have a group in my lab that's looking at how do you map from the biology to the physics of MRI to try and decouple that signal. And so then you say, okay, well, if I believe it's just cells, then what would the image look like? Now if I believe it's cells plus something, some confounder like inflammation or something like that, then what would the image look like? And iterate through those things and try and decouple that. And then, of course, I think in that context, you have to use other imaging. You have to add things like ADC MRI or perfusion MRI, a spectrum of other imaging modalities. PET, you could do anything, right? But you need to incorporate these other, like, multimodality stacking of data to really.
Or maybe a diffusion tensor to look at stiffness.
Exactly, yeah.
Question. Right there. So, when after resection, there's this cavity, this space is,
yep.
There's a space there. Do you think that the cells with intrinsic higher invasion capacity
are being selected for.
Be selected for because there's space or.
So that's what, let's skip ahead, that's what this slide is. So this slide is, hey, well, if we're sucking out a big chunk of the tumor, does that select for like one direction? So color code each dot according to size of resection. In this case, a lot of the patients ultimately have pretty large ones. These guys have little tiny ones. So you can say that they were more consistent, maybe, these little two tiny resections, because the size of the dot is both colored and sized according to how big the resection was. These little guys, these, you know, smaller guys, but you can see these huge gross floor resections, maybe it's going this direction. That seems to be more significantly going that direction. This is totally new data. I don't really know. I'm open to a lot of discussion on it and can probably generate a lot more. So that's one of the confounders is, I mean, just intuitively, I think you take out the middle, ignore even the biology, you're gonna artificially get like an apparent flattening of the relative diffusiveness. So I thought all of these would be high D over rho, higher, but it's not really that clear of signal. The clearest signal seems to be in the rho setting. So you can also go and say, I'm not even going to talk about pseudoprogression because that would just be confusing. What about timing of MRIs? Like, does it matter because we had more time to observe the growth, therefore our uncertainty bars are narrower, and in terms of modeling things, and so is this related? It doesn't seem to be related. And then went through and looked at various clinical endpoints in terms of univariate and multivariate analysis, and we're trying to detect what those things are saying. So I guess you had a question about uncertainty. So here's our picture of tumor uncertainty. If you have, let's say, T1 GAD looks like this, you can imagine a tumor that looks, a velocity that's reasonable is that one, the really fast one, medium one, slow one, right? You have a diversity of those. So you can do that. You can incorporate some metrics of uncertainty analysis from a measurement perspective, and then get scatters on your parameters. You constrain your parameters into some reasonable space. And then
those error bars on the previous slide are just sort of what's known about the MRI technology.
Yeah, this is like, so imagine this being measurement error. Yeah. Measurement error, like not even like modeled biology error.
Exactly.
This is just measurement error.
Yeah.
But you can then start thinking of, you know.
Right, of course.
Quantifying this uncertainty. And so steroids was asked about what is the role of steroids in terms of confounding that signal or maybe slowing down the T1, the T2, or even slowing anything down. So we don't see any really resounding signal that steroids could confound the answer in some smart way in this. And then I guess the last thing, so I'll cycle back through these slides for a few moments, but I wanted to just show you the overview of the data first.
Let me just say that you can take a little more time because if it's okay with you, Josh, we'll have you at 3:30 this afternoon instead. So we have this room, and I'll remind you about that. So you just take all the time you need.
Okay.
Don't feel pinched.
Okay. So if you were looking at different, with incorporating uncertainty or looking at different tumors, that let's say diagnostic rho versus recurrent rho, you could imagine they live in different boxes, right? Basically, the uncertainty bars are making at least a box. You can get more complex than that, but let's just think about a box. So this is definitively higher. This is a patient that went definitively lower as a result of at recurrence. Whereas this guy is, well, you know, part of the time it predicts one way or part of the other. So we just, that was incorporated into these data here for looking at each of the parameters. And so this is kind of graphically left to right. All of it, meaning resoundingly, all decreased versus all increased versus some shades of gray where there was some overlap like this guy in the middle. And you can see that the signal is quite high for rho. D is kind of all over the place. I kind of expected it always D to be getting more diffuse with treatment because if you're resecting out the center, then that should seem this. You should have an appearance of more diffuseness. There's rho. Here's D over rho, which this makes sense to me. So the rho and the D over rho seem to be the signal and maybe a little bit of the velocity, or velocity means looks to decrease compared to the pretreatment, which is kind of the confounder. So there's many, many ways you can interpret this, right? So you could say, well, I'm selecting out the proliferative guys that were in the middle by resecting it or treating the middle. They were really proliferative, so I've gotten rid of that population of cells, and all I've got left are the more invasive, kind of, less proliferative tumor cells, maybe. You could think of it as I'm selecting out the radio-resistant tumors or the chemotherapy-resistant cells are things like cancerous stem cell-like things. So they're not proliferating much. They're they're therefore resistant to therapy, so you have a shift in the distribution of the cells that you're looking at towards this phenotype. You could have, I think I made a general list of easier access to the central proliferative ones, right? You could have environmental differences. You now have sclerotic vessels at the edge, so you're scooching, those vessels don't allow for much more proliferation, and cells are constantly seeking new pioneering new regions to find a new place to proliferate in. And the real question is, this is intended to be a completely open question, how does one harness this to provide insight into how did we fail in the first setting? Did we fail in the first setting? Are we just using those tools, the existing standard of care tools, to the best of our ability? I strongly think we are not. And how do we therefore, incorporate this understanding of how recurrent disease is different than primary disease to optimize the primary treatment? And then we're currently have pending some analysis on validating this proliferative index story. So we're looking at Ki-67 labeling index, which is an index for cycling cells, as well as some cell death markers, as well as a variety of other tissue markers right now, and they'll probably be done next month. That result is pending to validate, is the signal we're seeing from an MRI perspective biologically consistent with what we're observing histologically? Mm-hmm. We'll find out.
So this is really great. It's a wealth of beautiful clinical data that you've very comprehensively analyzed, and I think it can guide a lot of future questions. So I was wondering what your thoughts are about translating this to animal models to really get answers that we can't get with human patients. So, for example, I think the mouse might be a difficult model because of its size, but say the rat C6 glioma, which recapitulates the human disease very faithfully in terms of its invasive properties and heterogeneity. Do you think that might be, animal models might be a good way to go to try to get a handle on what's really happening?
So I think the I think there's two paths that I think I would be, that I will play a role in working with. One is this, the PDGF-driven model, because I think there's some, that I was telling you about, I think there's some insights, like, I created this list, right? A million different, effectively infinite different possibilities to explain this data, right? So at some point you have to go back to the human tissue, you have to ask those questions. At some point you have to go back to some biological system that can constrain those opportunities, and so I think that would be a potential role for an animal exploration of some of this stuff. So, for instance, I'm very interested in microglia and sort of inflammation in the brain. And we've been looking at literally video microscopy, like that video, first video I showed with the cells migrating, where we have microglia cells and tumor cells together, presumably tumor cells, right? They're whatever they are in the rat that overexpress PDGF. They're normal progenitor cells that overexpress a lot of PDGF, okay? Whatever that is. But you can think about, from a cellular invasion perspective, how is the host responding to that invasion, right? And then you can constrain your mathematical models that you would then apply to the patient data. So that's the way I've my perspective on using animal work. I think the other interesting one is this PDX story. I think there's an opportunity to say, I have a patient, go into the OR, get some tissue, go straight into an animal, and straight into a culture. And how faithfully does that recapitulate what I think is going on from even the simple kinetic model perspective, I think an important question, because you can just talk about, we always talk about these lines about, it's passage, God only knows what, and so is this really the same thing we're talking about now? I know the first time we put it in, it was really diffuse and it was, gliomatosis, cerebri, and now it's this nice little nodule that I can just like pop right out and I can do my great analysis on it, but is it really the same thing, or is it a subpopulation of the cells that was there in the diversity in the first place? I mean, I think that's a very interesting biological question to understand how, when you go back to an animal model, how do you predict forward again? Right? Yeah. I think that circle, elucidating that circle, I think is imperative, since we base so much on work on the animal. But I'm kind of stubborn, if you haven't noticed. And I like to do as much as I can with the human data. I'm really focused on trying to do that as much as I can, and try and find strategic opportunities to collaborate with folks that are interested from more of an experimental biology perspective or an animal model perspective to speak to some, like some of the questions you were asking, I think are spot on, and it's like figuring out how you map those two things back together, I think is important.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna ask Bob, is like, you know, if we go back to the conversations of last week and we were talking about how important the environment and the ecology, and so, I mean, you go, you take human cells and you put them in to a mouse or a rat or primate environment. I mean, you're changing many of the characteristics that you're talking about, right? The tissue characteristics, the mechanics of them, the blood vessel distribution, all that kind of stuff is going to be extremely different. And so, can you, using other means than what we've been looking at, pull some of those, that data from the existing human tissue that we have, or from other radiographic measurements that we may make? Can we pull out, let's say, stiffness or tissue mechanics or edema or, you know?
My belief system is more of like a multimodality, you know, even though here I focus totally on T1, yet T2, that's on the purpose of how do I reach all patients. But I think the reality of being able to stack fancy imaging, right, which we spend lots of resources being able to make, stack what we understand about that imaging together in a patient and use that like multimodality approach to extract out additional layers of information. That's the energy that I will.
So I agree, and I would add to the stacking and the multimodality other things besides imaging. So for instance,
sure.
I think that one of the really powerful approaches to understanding what you see at diagnosis, through treatment, and at recurrence would be sequencing at diagnosis and at recurrence when you get tissue, so that you can look at clonal heterogeneity and you can look at what the specific patterns of mutations, how they have changed as a consequence of treatment. And so do you see signatures of tumors that give you that rapid growth and dissemination in the patterns of mutations or in the clonal heterogeneity? Is the drop in proliferation a consequence of the fact that you've created such a mutation burden that cells are actually past their prime sort of robustness? They're now on the falling side of robustness. They're recurrent, they're resistant to therapy, but they're not intrinsically as robust as the clones that existed prior to therapy. I think that's an element of data stacking together with what you have there. And similarly,
I agree with the concept of stacking, not just imaging data. I totally agree with that part.
But not with the sequencing part.
I'm ready with some sequencing data. I think jury is out.
But I also think the idea of PDXs into tumors is not that you're going to recapitulate what's happened in humans, but that you're going to create you're going to create a different context in which you still can measure relative differences, so that you can have a cell that's highly invasive, and if that property is maintained in the rodent brain,
which
then
is
that's
unknown.
Informative. Well, it's unknown sometimes, but
yeah.
frequently those PDXs are highly invasive.
But the story I always ask about on the PDX story is that I find fascinating is I've had conversations with Peter about this, but just was talking about repeatedly, we go around this same little wagon. And the wagon is, we take it from the patient, we put it in the animal, it's extremely diffuse, it's like gliomatosis or something, you know, something like that. And then, but you know, we get it under control, and a couple cycles later, we're good, and then we can use it, and you're,
But that's clonal, I mean, in our own hands, that's clonal selection.
That's exactly right, and so the degree in which we then move forward and make decisions about that clonally selected thing, is that thing more representative of the human disease or less?
I don't know.
I
agree with you, it's the initial, very short
right. Which is thrown away because it's gliomatosis, and how do you handle it? Because it's a small brain. So I really love this question of how do you quantitatively connect what you're doing in the animal, and then you track that over passages. I love that. I think that's really fascinating to say, if we have some understanding of the heterogeneity we observe in the patient and some kinetic understanding of the diversity, then that one patient, then how does that diversity play out or not in this? I think is really important to how we move forward with all.
You haven't mentioned the immune system. That I
hey, I talked about microglia.
Okay, so
several times.
Because they're my new favorite thing. Mm-hmm. Not new, but I've been begging for some data on that.
Is that because we don't think the immune system plays a role in the tumor dynamics, or I guess that was my question.
So let's,
do you think?
The way I would answer it is that at least I think it's 20% of glioma specimens within the specimen is at least 20% macrophage, microglia. So I think anything that measures to that level is probably significant. Just a gander, but just guess. But how it is and what role it's playing, that's why I'm interested in that invasion thing, because I don't know. I'd just like to constrain the possibilities of modeling of what's leading what. I do think it's relevant. I think it's certainly relevant in the generic term that they use in tumor board is, you know, post-radiation changes, kind of like post-operative changes, right? There's this change to the environment, this radical cataclysm. Joel would have some really cataclysmic words for it, right? That the brain has been, you know, beat to daylights. And so how do you, there's also sorts of pro-inflammatory reactions and relevant things there.
Okay. I'm sorry, just follow. Yeah. I was at a conference at the NCI a couple of years ago, and there was a significant disagreement going on about the role.
I'm hoping I'm being disagreeable enough up here. I'm really trying hard.
Of the viral initiators, yeah, in GBM. Is that a resolved issue? Or
say that again?
The role of viruses as an initiator in GBM. Right?
Other than the PDGF one, I don't know.
Well, it's controversial, and it comes down to sort of faith-based versus fact-based. Oh. So in the whole genome sequencing data, there's evidence of, you know, viral fragments.
Yeah.
And the question is that, are those passengers, or are they just, you know, bystanders? Or in fact, are they driving? There are some papers that have slipped into major publications that, you know, the patient community has glommed onto, and so antiviral therapy, in fact, is a big request by a lot of patients. But I don't think there is hardcore experimental data that viral genesis of tumors is a real thing.
Yeah, I mean, it was to the point where one person in the room said the 100% of his samples showed viral.
Oh, fragment DNA, absolutely.
And someone in the audience saying 0% of mine.
Yeah.
That's a big spread.
Diversity is good.
I wonder if you could talk about what we're looking
for. Yeah. That's where I was. This goes to the thread of the connection to the molecular profiling. So I mentioned the TCGA earlier, and this atlas or database, whatever, it has roughly 500 GBMs in it, right? And of that, about, at the time I did this analysis, about 100 of the patients had MRIs. So you could do our D-row scatter, right? And then just look at your molecular phenotype. And so this is just one vignette, one example from this, where we did differential gene expression based on net proliferation rate. So basically, what gene expression profile was correlated with the net proliferation rate kinetically, right? So this is a subset of 84 patients that we could do the image analysis on, of the 103 that we had images on. I found some interesting genes for various reasons. Some people are interested in those lists. There seems to be some rooms that are people have as their target. But the point is what was interesting here is that you could then use this gene signature to say, look, patients that are more molecularly in this set of genes, more expressive in this set of genes, or less expressive in this set of genes, they had a higher net proliferation rate we would expect from a molecular perspective. And so we used the 84 patient subset to get a signature. We then applied that signature to the full 500 patient database and said, do those patients that we molecularly predict to have bad row, were those bad patients or bad outcomes for those patients? And oh, shoot. These are my backup slides, so there's no ordering at all, just chaos. And there you go. That's what you observed, is that there was at least a statistically significant difference, although, you know, some challenges to this curve, that you could use this as connecting biology, right? So this is another one of those things is, now, multiple people have asked questions like, how do you glean more levels of biology from this sort of data? And this is, I think, a holism that you could use, right? Is connect from molecular expression profiles to imaging kinetic features, merge those together, and then make some sort of, you know, biological predictions. So we currently are validating this on a separate 150 patient cohort. So, because I think there's a lot of signatures out there without validations, so we're validating this on a separate cohort. Literally right now, so we will we'll see. But that goes to your question of, like, you know, I think there's a lot of opportunity to get to. I think there's also nobody has bitten so far on the very wide open questions. I didn't answer any questions with these data, right? So I'm going to put it back up here so we can.
Can I ask a question about how you measure each of these? So coming from an ecology standpoint, I'm imagining forest, and you burn down the very middle acre of it. You just burn it to the ground. Everything, you just kill it, right? Which
Got
is
it.
The
yep.
Resection. So
resection and radiation, you know, combo.
Sure, the fire kind of screws up everything, and yeah, okay, that sort of works. But you've got this hole in the middle that's now just empty. Maybe fire isn't the right idea.
Fire's not a good idea because after fire, there's, you know, that's a good environment for people.
Yeah, just don't think too hard about the fire. You get what I'm trying to get at. So when you make these measurements, right, like velocity, that's growing of the tumor out, is it from a center point out?
So this is a volumetric segmentation.
Volumetric
segmentation. So this is also tricky, right? But yeah. Most of the times you're not using, you kind of visualize this as a halo around a hole.
Yeah.
But most of the times it's actually, well, the surgical specimen probably left more cells this direction, and so it's more of a nodular expansion, but not always.
Right.
Some of this could be halo around a hole, but it's going to be a mixed bag. So
yeah.
Geometrically pulling this out, we actually have some other techniques that are developed in the lab that more speak to this geometrically instead of volumetric approximations.
Right.
And I think that'll clean up, that might clean up some of the signal, and that might be something we just have to do. Because I think this is too messy to me. It doesn't...
Because like invasion profile depends which direction you're measuring the invasion in. And if you take out the middle, it might slow its invasion into the outer.
Because there's a wall there.
Because there's all this space in the middle that's like, ooh, I have all this...
But it can't go into that space because there's no tissue there. Right, so the cells aren't migrating into that space, but they could expand and swell into that space. But they can't really, like,
and
go in. They'd swim.
It's important to mention back to the fact they're not autonomous in their growth. They are dependent upon their environment. So they wouldn't go into that center space.
And you never see cells in that center space.
It grows, like, so that one example, right? It'll grow, like, expansile.
I'm just saying, you might be selecting for this weird type of cell that loves surgical gel. You know, I don't know.
But if they need endothelial cells, and they probably need...
So, like, here. Oh, where'd it go? Okay.
But
there. See this guy? See this? That this was a hole. Oh, I don't show the picture.
But
there, this is a hole right here.
Fashion here. Just saying, it's a whole different way to think about it.
So this is a hole right here, and so this thing is expanding into the hole, like from a bulbous perspective, but not from like a. There's no cells there because it's just void.
Sure. Okay.
So to get to Jessica's analogy, instead of like a fire or something, it would be as if you dug out a hole. I mean, you brought your backhoe in, and you removed all the topsoil, you know, there's nothing then for the seeds or the tree streets or anything.
And maybe filled with concrete, okay.
Yeah.
Well, then I think from the radiation perspective, it's probably closer to the fire. Because you don't know if after the fire, it's like a rich environment for trees to grow again in, or is it like a really rich environment for like bad beastie cells to grow in or
But it's gel there, no? You don't have any blood vessels.
Right, so in the hole, but not in the radiation. In the radiation field, it's normal tissue. Right, so this is the weird balancing act. This is really important, relevant to all week, right, as we think about the practicalities of this. The standard way you approach radiation is this. You take halos around the T1GAD and the T2 and you put different doses to it, and those doses are based on, well, how can we kind of retain function in the fact that I just radiated the heck out of the hole, I don't know, there, right? So we kind of balance, there's a balancing act that creates these profiles of what's called conformal radiation therapy. But here's another visual of it, right? So if this is the T2 abnormality, you add a couple centimeters, and you know this is our target to the red zone. And the red zone's like, I think, 50 gray. What we've done is, if you have an ideal understanding of the iceberg shape and the cell density that's, you just fill in the cell density that you would infer to be normal tissue, you would get, you can apply very simple rules. So there's, imagine you're standing in the center of this tumor and you're just radiating out in 1D, you know, that's the tumor cell density, this would be like a normal cell density. You can optimize that. Right now, the standard of care is that. So you can see a of the term butt ton of normal tissue that's exposed to radiation dose, but this profile is for two features. One, because we know it's diffuse, and so what's the most diffuse it could be? Because we don't want to fail in the field. But on the other hand, we don't want, we also have to keep that dose low enough to, because we want their patient to actually like still be able to think. Mm-hmm. Although the cognitive function changes dramatically. So patients, this is very relevant to all the questions this week, is that patients will have kind of nothing wrong. They'll show up with a seizure, and within 6 weeks, they'll go from, what, I have a tumor? What are you talking about? To 6 weeks later, oh, I definitely have a tumor, because they've been radiated, right? So there's a huge amount of side effect profile that's associated with this sort of strategy, and that's known, but there's this whole, we don't want to fail inside the field. We need to know if we fail so much inside the field, we just got to keep radiating that area, because that's the most important thing we can do. But you could take optimization of protocols, so this is a multi-objective optimization protocol. One example of them, you could choose different strategies. This was minimize normal tissue exposure, maximize dose to tumor cells by predicting that after radiation there would be a minimum number of cells left, and like you can't give more than X amount per fraction, right? So this is actually not absurd, the volume, the radiation dose here is pretty high, but people have done standard of care protocols like this where they've boosted in the T1 GAD abnormality up to 90 to 100. This sort of range has happened. They just didn't find any big benefit. So what this would do would be more individualized the curve across the patients. And so here's like the pile of patients ordered from diffuseness. So, very nodular, very diffuse. And you can see that there's a different structuring. And so what we did is the simulations of this to say, what would we predict the temporal deflection, so the days gained, would be for the simulated radiation dosing compared to standard of care for each of the patients, and that's what this bottom graphic is here. So from the optimized dosing would be significant enough to kill additional tumor cells and therefore deflect the tumor off of its growth curve, but dramatically decrease the normal tissue toxicity. The normal tissue exposure for standard care is there. This is with the optimization. So predictively, that's where we stand on, this is one of the grants in my group, this is where we stand on moving forward to the next phase of, do we then do this for everybody? I'm trying to introduce that, which, yeah.
Well, the thing that strikes me is that without knowing anything about this cancer before this morning, that the probability of killing a cell is independent of its density. So, in other words, as you drop the radiation intensity as you move away, you're dropping the probability of killing those few cells.
That's exactly. So it's like imagining, you know, it's like dose per cell is the same.
Yeah.
You're kind of like almost optimizing on dose per cell, but it's not exactly that, because there is definitely some additive, in the patient data we've observed for standard of care, there is an additive effect of more cells being there. So if you wanted to optimize dose per cell, you would have a radiation dose that's exactly the shape of this, right? The reason it's not is a couple things.
Right? Well, I feel like I'm being a little bit dumb, but the total density of cells is not changing as you move away from the tumor. Total cells is not changing.
Correct.
The sum of the blue and the black, and so.
But the radiosensitivity would be higher of these cells than these cells, because presumably normal cells aren't proliferating, whereas these cells are.
But they may not. In fact, they are evidently radiosensitive because patients report loss of cognitive ability.
Yes. Right. Of course. No. Of course. Right. Radiation is not good for things.
No.
no matter. But it's particularly worse for things that are cycling. So that's at least okay. The concept, but that's the balancing act that creates these red curves,
yeah.
Right? The standard of care curves. What we're going to say is that at high cell densities, meaning within tumor,
yeah.
we know we're hypoxic, which at least in a petri dish, it takes 3 times the dose of radiation to kill the same cell. So in the hypoxic state versus the oxic state, so that's relevant. So there's going to be some suppression over here. Like, why add more dose here? Because you're just not going to get anything for it. You're not going to gain any traction. The central necrosis, it's already dead, so not to kill again.
That's why your peaks are often.
They're at the peak of the gradient.
Yeah.
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 That's exactly where they're at. And then there's a couple other secondary effects of having lots of cells around, but those are some of the. And interstitial pressure would be also.
So coming from, again, ecology, I'm filling in for Joel here.
Good.
So in the Muir models, it's kind of all, it's this net effect. There's proliferation and there's invasion, right? So let's pretend that there's two species of cells. There's some that are really good at staying still and proliferating, probably maybe the ones in the center, and then the ones that are not really proliferating because they're running around like crazy, and those are the ones that you'll see diffusely outside of the main part of the tumor. So is there a way that, I mean, I guess this is like probably a decade of work, actually, now that I'm thinking about it, but the radiation therapy is really good at killing the proliferating cells, but not the invading cells, pretending that they're separate species and that one is doing one and not the other, which might not be true.
Mathematically, I could probably get really turned the dog or something.
We love it, it's fine. You can leave it.
I was trying to find the picture of exactly that. So one of our projects is called BONK, Ecology Network of Knowledge, is is kind of trying to get to this, right? So again, how do you use all this patient data to we know, number one, it's not MICE, MRIs are not just these lines, which I think I beat that horse, but now let's think about populations of cells, right? So now we know it's heterogeneous. We know we biopsy up these cells, we can put two cells next to each other, they're gonna sequence even differently, right? Yeah. There's a cellular composition perspective. So in that context, we've been working with Sandy at the IMO, Integrative Mathematical Oncology Department at Moffitt, on looking at single cell models, right? So cellular automata models where there is diversity.
Yeah.
And if there's diversity in where we're using these animal model, like to understand what kind of diversity would you observe from like a cell tracking perspective?
Yeah.
And so you get quantitative diversity in the cellular phenotypes, the behaviors, from like a migration perspective or in proliferation perspective, and then you use that to understand, well, if radiation is getting only those fast guys, is this just like a duh answer?
Right.
And if it is a duh answer, how do we still use it to do something better for the patients, right?
Yeah.
I'm okay if it's a duh answer. I'm totally fine with that. That's like the best modeling day in the world, right? Is when you're at the end of the day, you can explain it so clearly that it's, well, just duh.
Right.
That's sad that we haven't come to that conclusion before, but fine, duh. But how do you use it is I think where this conversation this week is placed.
Yeah.
And
try and push all the cells to be proliferative and then radiate shit.
So which there are people that believe in this.
Yeah.
Growth factor people.
That's right. So among the non-proliferative cells are the stem cells. They contain a significant fraction of cells that are quiescent. And that's true presumably within multiple genetic lineages within tumors, and it occurs in this perivascular domain.
Okay.
And it's been demonstrated that they're radio resistant while in that domain.
Yeah.
But you can mobilize them from that domain.
Cool.
And once they're mobilized from that domain, they're presumably their radiation sensitivity and their chemosensitivity will increase. So that's exactly what.
Are there chemotactic? Are there persistent chemotactic?
Are you going to pull out the whole I'm going to home them to this dot in my head?
I'm sorry?
Is this where we're going?
Yeah, have a heart trap.
There are definitely
really
people that believe in this idea.
Yeah, and at least make them recur at a spot where you can control them. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you have a heart trap, if you could place a
have a heart trap? What's that? Have a heart trap?
Well,
have a heart wild. Okay, got it. All right. I was like VEGF trap. I don't get it.
You just sort of lure them in, you know, and
this is the dream of all neurosurgeons.
Really is. Yes.
They're going to lure all the tumor cells back into that.
How do they move?
And then they're going to take them out again.
Well, there's so many gradients going away, right? Interstitial pressure only being only one of them.
Yes.
There are chemotactic gradients as well, and to reverse all those is kind of a tough road to hoe, I would guess.
Yeah, I think that's why we haven't had much traction on that particular perspective. I think the concept is there, but I also think that somebody made this profound statement to me one time. She was a neurologist in Seattle, but not in research. And we were just at a dinner thing, chatting one night, and she says, you know, I just always believed that there was like some field thing that, you know, just told them, you know, as far away as you can think in the brain, okay, now your tumor, you behave like a tumor cell, right? And so follow the thread, maybe a little bit of heresy here. So on the PDGF experiment. You inject this retrovirus, you infect a normal progenitor cell with overexpression that results in overexpression of PDGF. That PDGF signal tells everybody, do something, do something, do something. So these normal progenitor cells migrate and proliferate just like their tumor cells. The rates at which they're doing it is exactly the same rates as the infected cells. So they're doing something, but they're not bad guys. They're just along for the ride. Now think in the context of the brain, where this speaks to this all the time. Right, and so you've built evolutionarily, right? This is the evolution thing, right? Evolution has made it so this and this can communicate, right? So now we have to usurp those tools for those to communicate. There's millions of ways in which I think it can fail for you to think of just homing them, because I don't think you can get to them, because there's always a way to communicate to send some signal over here.
Yeah, actually, I was just thinking more locally than that. Like that one, if you go back to the image.
Which one?
Go back.
That one.
No, that one.
Oh, this one?
No.
So this is good. This could take a while. You want the like recurrent the nodule?
The one where it is in the right temporal lobe.
The recurrence or the?
Yeah, where it occurred.
That's right. It's like right. It's one of these. And no, it's not that one. It's that one.
Yeah, so if you took out that little that local recurrence there, would it just I assume it would recur again and again and again.
But you'll find is they'll go in and say, oh well, you know what, we could do a bigger temporal lobectomy. I'm making this up, okay.
Yeah.
Let's cut to here.
Yeah.
And do a big temporal lobectomy, and the next thing you know it'll be there. And so that's a common, I think a lot of that is explainable, just like we were talking about this anti-angiogenic thing. I think a lot of that signal is explainable by just simply the geometry of a cell, of knowing that there are walls. And not less about, you know, if we had complete green pastures, you cut out the center, chances are you're gonna get exactly a ring recurrence. Whereas I think.
So sometimes the pioneers become engineers, make 4 million columns.
Yes. But I don't know that that's anything special about those cells other than the geometry of the brain going, oh, there's a wall. Oh, wait, okay, that means I've run into other people and other people are gonna run into me. It's unclear to me how much of the signal that you observe of, oh my goodness, it was recurred over here is a function of just simply expansion of something that's shaped like this encountering walls. And how much of it is we have to change who we are to, and we've decided at this distance to change who we are and be something else. I just don't know.
But okay. Sequencing can help you there. I'll show you some data.
Yeah, great.
Because in fact, the different environments, impose different pressures.
One of the cool things I think about in the sequencing concept is that this paper that's just out on cellular composition, peeling out the signal that is because these things are so gradient. You know, they're mixed with all this other stuff, right? And so you have normal cells, and you have all these other signals in there. And how do you pull out all the normal stuff or the reactive stuff, and then just add just the driver cell, not driver mutation, driver cell, the tumorigenic cell. How do you get kind of that signal? So I think I agree.
All right.
I think we beat that horse.
Yeah, we did pretty well. So thank you very much for your.